Thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week, this show will address many ways of creating greater health, joy, and love for those in you and those you care about. We will introduce you to top professionals and talented authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please, forward this show to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from today's subject. This is one powerful way that we can make a positive difference together. Now, I want you all to know that I am grateful that you take your time to listen to, or in some cases, watch this show, and especially those that send in questions, comments, reviews, and suggestions, because please remember, this show exists for you. Now, if you haven't gotten your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal yet, please go to our website at answers.network and download a copy. Give it 21 days and comment on whatever platform you listen to us on, what focusing on gratitude has meant for you and your loved ones. And if you would like to send them to us via our website, we will read some of them on the air. Now, as many of you know, if you've listened to this show for any time at all, you know that I believe that one of the best ways for us to make a positive difference in the world is to focus on love, gratitude, and finding your own path to making a difference in the lives of others. Well, our guest today is certainly doing that. Erica Elliott, MD, came to medicine later than most medical students, first pursuing other careers of interest, including teaching, herding sheep, mountain climbing, and serving as an instructor for Outward Bound students, wilderness survival in the Rocky Mountains. As a physician, Erica has worked in a number of settings, including indigent care, emergency rooms, a woman's clinic, and starting in 1993, her own practice. Now, the years she has spent living in foreign cultures has enabled her to bring a fresh perspective to her life's work. Now, she's nicknamed the health detective, which I can relate to. She finds deep meaning and purpose through helping her patients find relief from their suffering. Now, she is the co-author of Prescriptions for a Healthy House and the author of today's subject, Medicine and Miracles in the High Desert, My Life Among the Navajo People, which, among many other things, reveals how diversity and inclusiveness can enrich our society, a lesson on which the stability of our future may just depend on it. Erica, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you, Alan.
I was so excited to read your book. And one of the things I want to share with everybody about the book is I'm a very visual person. And the fact that you've included so many pictures, it allows, I think, those of us that maybe are amongst our generation anyway, that are more visually motivated, to see it while I'm reading it and to have you explain something, but at the same time for me to look at something and say, yeah, I remember where I was at in 1973, and that's where this picture is from. So I think that made reading the book so much more enjoyable, but also I felt like I could connect with it so much better.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I'm the same way. I love pictures.
So share with the audience a little bit more about you, because you've led such an interesting life. And I think a lot of people would start by wondering what was going on in your childhood that may have foreshadowed a little bit as to you going in this direction in life.
I felt I was different from other kids in that I felt that I was here for a purpose, mm-hmm. and that I had no idea what it was. But, and so when I, after college, I decided I was going to actually try and find it. But seeds had already been planted, but they didn't get watered for a long time. And one of the seeds was visiting my uncle in Switzerland. I'm the third generation doctor on the side, and my grandfather was a doctor, my mother's brother was a doctor, but I didn't see that as my destiny. And actually, it's good that I didn't realize right away, because I would have never gotten the depth of life experience that I could give to my patients. I would have been like the regular medical student who goes on a conveyor belt, high school, college, med school, really not having any deep, meaningful life experiences. And mm-hmm. and so it was good. I didn't realize that that was my destiny. But the seed that was planted is after college, I went to visit my uncle in Switzerland, and he was the only doctor I'd ever known. So I thought that doctors all had to be, you had to be a genius to be a doctor. My father said he was a quack, and my mother said he was the most brilliant man she had ever known in her life. And so I thought, I'm going to figure out what's the truth.
Right.
And the truth is, at first I thought my father was right, because he was doing things that were 50 years ahead of his time. So they looked crazy, mm-hmm. you know, and then I started interviewing. I felt like I was an investigative journalist. And so I interviewed his patients, and he had me go through his whole treatment. I said, why am I supposed to fast and do all that stuff? I'm just here to report things. And he said, because you're toxic. And I said, this was 1970. I said, toxic? That sounds like an oil spill or something.
Yeah.
And I'm toxic. And he said, how do you know? How are toxic? I said, what? And I thought, this guy is a nutcase. And he said, because, you know, you eat polluted food and all this stuff and so forth. And I really thought, he is crazy. But anyway, I went along with it. And I almost escaped, because I thought, fasting, I'm going to starve to death and I'm going to die from not eating. I was so ignorant. And so, but after interviewing his patients, I realized, this guy is like in a category all by himself. And because he was such a visionary and with deep desire to help his patients and get well and stuff, I thought, I can never measure up to him. Complete all the way around the world and here and there, until I realized, oh my God, you don't, these kids who are doing pre-med aren't even that smart. They don't do any critical thinking. Mm-hmm. And I had a misconception. I realized they're ordinary kids. All the thing that they really have going for them is their ability to memorize and spit back. And right. So I thought, geez, I can do that. And so that began my realization. I mean, this is my path. And I thought I was on the right path, but being in mainstream medicine, it dawned on me, this is not what I was searching my whole life for, just to give out pills and talk to a patient who's in great distress for 15 minutes. I think this is terrible. This is not meaningful to me at all. That's when, and oh my God, I just love practicing medicine this way, because it's so meaningful. I have deep relationships with the patient, meaning I understand what's going on with them. I know their family. I know all their grandparents and stuff like that. And I try to find the underlying cause. I don't want to just give pills to all their lifestyle problems. Right. You know, I think that's terrible myself. I think it's a broken system. And this way, on my own, I can do what I want. And I can practice with pure integrity and not just do what the insurance company tells us to do and the corporations. And I'm 73 and I have no desire to retire, because I'm doing what fills my soul and gives me so much meaning.
Well, there was a few things in there that stuck with me. One was, is that, yes, it sounds like you started as a detective at a very, very early age. And the other thought, when you mentioned the thing about your uncle and crazy, that if anybody takes the time to look back at history, nearly every person who made a huge contribution to our world and to our society was first thought to be crazy. You know, so, you know, every great thing that they came up with, you know, when somebody, you know, when somebody said, okay, well, you know, we're going to fly in the air on airplanes and stuff. And they know you guys are crazy, you know? So yeah, so I've gotten to the point now to where when I bring up something and somebody gets, well, that's crazy. And I go, thank you. So that I mentioned in the beginning had to do with the sheep herding. How did sheep herding become one of the things that you ended up doing, and how did that benefit you?
Okay, I taught school for 2 years, and I'd like to tell you about how that happened and so forth. But so at the end of 2 years, I had developed such a love and passion for Navajo people and their culture and their land that I decided to take it even a step further and live with a family that didn't speak any English, except that the mother knew how to say water, wada, because water was so scarce. Mm-hmm. And they lived very simply, and they were actually considered very wealthy, not because of money in the bank, but they had 100 people, and that was considered wealth, and it was tangible wealth. And they had a lot of gorgeous turquoise jewelry. And that's how they paid me, is in old jewelry. Wow. That I just cherish, and $100 a month. And I took over their son, who had mental cognitive problems. And he never really learned English either. And so he said I could have his job. And so they taught me how to herd sheep. They taught me how to shear sheep, card the wool, spin it. And I already knew how to weave because I was taught that while I was teaching school. And they taught me how to butcher, and they did it in a very sacred way. They used corn pollen, and they said a prayer asking Brother Sheep to give his life so their people could go on living. It was very sort of sanctifying, the whole thing. And I was terribly impressed. And I learned to live the way they did, and I really improved my Navajo. I mean, I had no choice. They didn't speak English. And so I really, I already knew Navajo, but very, you know, I talk like a five-year-old. And so I became more conversant. And one of the things I took away that lasted my whole life up to now is realizing that we don't need much to have a very rich life. In fact, I was sort of repulsed, to tell you the truth, when I went back to regular Biligana, that's what they called us white people, Biligana life. It seemed so overloaded with material stuff. And I sort of felt sorry for our culture because it did not enrich them. It made them feel like they had to keep getting more and more to feel some emptiness in them. And I, so that profoundly affected me. And I learned about herbs and for medicinal and for healing animals and plants. And that struck me too, how powerful. I mean, if some of these ailments, if they went to mainstream, these are all better. And the sheep, when they were sick, they just give these herbs and they make a tea. I was astounded and saw how powerful, if you know what you're doing, how powerful this is.
Now, one of the things that you talk about in the book, which I love, is you talk about miracles. Share with our audience some of the miracles that you observed in the Navajo healing ceremonies.
Okay, well, by the way, the first miracle I experienced had nothing to do with the ceremonies. The miracle was when I finally had a breakthrough with the students, because at first they wouldn't talk to me. They wouldn't look at me. Nobody communicated with me. It was awful. And I was ready to go home because I couldn't get to first base as a teacher. And they didn't speak English, and they're in the fourth grade. And so the miracle was when I told my father I wanted to go home, and he said, this is not for me. It's not working out. It's so awkward. I stand in front of the class and I end up reading to them, and they're not even interested and they can't understand what I'm saying. And he said, I think it's too early to make a judgment. You've only been there a week. Why don't you stay 3 months? And then if you're still unhappy, you come back east and find a teaching position there. So I said, okay, thinking I'm definitely going home. This is not working. And that next day, the teacher aide, Donna Scott, who knew the white world because she'd lived on army bases with her famous father, Carl Gorman, who was a code talker, very famous code talker in World War II. And so she spoke fluent English, and she had a foot in both worlds. So she said, she finally spoke up, because traditional Navajos I'm talking about can be very shy initially because they don't want to be intrusive. But finally she spoke up and she said, I see how hard you're trying. Unlike the white teachers, they don't really try at all to connect with the students. She said, I'm going to help you. She said, I'm going to teach you a few words of Navajo, and you say it the next day. You come in the class and see what happens. So she taught me a few sentences, and I practiced and practiced and practiced into the night these very weird sounds, like, and like, izim means goat, chai means dog, Begashi means cow. It's very difficult language. And so I walked into the room. I was trying to say, hello, my children. My name is Miss Elliot. What's your name? Where do you come from? And this is what I said. And everybody looked up in shock. And this is the first time we made eye contact. And one of the girls put their hand over her mouth and giggled. And then the whole class burst out laughing. And that was the beginning of a love affair between me and the students. Everything changed from that moment on. I was invited into their world. And I went deeper and deeper and deeper into their world, because the bravest boy in the class, who spoke the most English, came up to my desk and said, Elliot, that was too common. I said, what? And I looked at Donna Scott, and she said, he wants you to check him out of the boarding school on the weekend. I said, am I allowed to do that? And she said, yeah, but nobody does it. And so these kids go without seeing their parents for months and months and months. So I checked out Billy Begay on the weekend, and we went deep into Canyon de Chelly, very remote. That's why they're in boarding schools. They can't make it every day to the town. And oh my God, nobody spoke English, and they included me in everything. And so that's one kind of miracle. Now I'll tell you about, and that miracle is about crossing the cultural divide. And it was so profound for me, just making that first step, that first effort, opened so many doors, because then they saw how hard I was trying to learn about them, and they wanted desperately for me to know about their lives. So they learned English so fast that, Alan, I'm not joking, they went from not really speaking English to three of them won a regional speech contest by the end of the year. And that is a miracle. How can that possibly be? It's from love. They knew I cared about them, and it made them come alive. I saw a side of them that the white teachers never saw. They actually told me, this is so shameful, they told me these kids didn't know how to learn. and weren't very smart. They were extremely smart. They had totally been miscategorized and misjudged. It's horrible. And anyway, that's the miracle. That's one miracle.
Well, but before you go on to the next miracle, did anybody ever tell you what you actually said that first time that made them crack up?
Because they said they were just touched that what I said, I so mispronounced the words that they didn't know what the heck I was saying, but they were so moved that I made the effort. Mm-hmm. And I found out later, I probably didn't make any sense at all, except saying my own name. That's the only thing that was right. And I made some terrible pronunciation errors where I ended up saying some bad things by accident. So because it's a tonal language, like Chinese, like in English, there's basically two ways to say A, like A and A. Okay, that same A in Navajo can be pronounced maybe 10 ways. I mean, can you imagine? They were so kind to me, except for one mistake. It was so horrendous, the mistake I made. The little boy never made eye contact with me again because I said something bad. I thought I said, come here, my relative. And I said something else. So, I'm not going to say what I said because okay. It's so embarrassing.
So share with us another miracle.
Okay. So one of the families, they wanted to adopt me. I mean, not literally, but, and they gave me a Navajo name, which is very, very funny. It's, I think, they have a funny sense of humor. It's not our kind of humor, but it's a different kind. But I think I grew to love it. So they called me Asahlechi. That means Navajo woman with red skin. So I was a redskin. And I said, how can I be a redskin? And they said, because you're sunburned all the time. And so they're very concrete and descriptive. And so they wanted to adopt me, and I was supposed to call them all by relational terms, like my mother, my sister, and stuff like that. That's how they show affection, by the way. If you say to somebody, my little brother, you're showing kindness to that person. You call them by a relational term. And because relations in the Navajo culture are everything, that's the highest priority, is your family and your clan, your people. And so I learned that I called everybody by some kind of family kind of term, my cousin, whatever. I adopted that. And so they said, we'd like to invite you to our Native American church. It was one. And I had only been there for about 6 weeks or so. And I was just barely learning Navajo by then. And they explained that they use plant medicine. And then I asked deeper, what is that? You mean, what do you do exactly? And they said, well, we use it to pray. I didn't. And then they said peyote in English. And I said, oh, I got kind of scared because, you know, that could, you don't know how that's going to work out. And so, they said, you can't wear white people's clothes in there. You have to dress traditional. So they dressed me up really beautifully, velvet blouse, satin skirt, concha belt, turquoise everywhere. I looked like I was going to go to a Navajo prom or something. I looked really the yarn and everything. And my Navajo mother sat next to me and she said, you know, I'll help you, you know, translate when we need to. And, you know, when the sacred tobacco comes your way, just pass it on, and the water drum, just pass it on, and just basically observe. And so we went in there, and so it was very emotional. And white people have stereotyped, you know, 50 years ago at Native Americans as, you know, being humorless and, you know, never laughing or crying. And that's so not true. Wow. It's just they're reserved and they save that for people they're close with because, wow, people were crying in there, calling out to Jesus. I'd hear the word Jesus. And then and we're healing a sick baby. And the baby had a high fever and the skin was so hot. It was copper colored and the eyes were all kind of foggy. And the baby was very fussy. And so I was sort of focusing on the baby. And so we're singing and chanting and praying. And then the road man, which is like a medicine man, but it's for the peyote, they go up into the mountains, into the San Francisco peaks, and get the sacred herbs to make into the homemade cigarettes. And so what you do is you inhale, exhale, and then you pray. And so it was going around, and my Navajo mother said, handed it to me and said, on. And I inhaled and exhaled, and I started praying in Navajo. Nice. And I thought, wow, I'm praying in Navajo. I don't even barely know the language. I don't even, how did this happen? And then I thought, well, I must be, this peyote is making me hallucinate. It's making me think this is real. This cannot be real. And then I said, but this is more real than real. No, this can't. I had a little dialogue going while I was praying. And I just thought, oh, this isn't really happening. And I passed it on. And then the same thing with the water drum. When it came around, my Navajo mother said, pass it on. And I didn't. I put the water drum, which is meditated over worldly sound. I started beating it and I started singing a song I never heard before in Navajo. Hey, nay, young, hey, nay, oh, hey, you, oh, young. I thought, oh, wow, I'm having more hallucinations. This is not happening. And I passed it on. Anyway, so when the ceremony came to an end, as dawn came, we filed out and we touched our forehead to the ground and we blessed ourselves with our eagle feather fans. Then we walked into the cinder block house next door where some of the women had stayed up all night creating a big feast for breakfast. So we sat on a sheet on the floor and had, you know, mutton stew and fried bread and canned peaches. And we're all sitting around there. And then the roadman looks at me and starts talking nonstop. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a clue what he's saying. And he's talking very fervently to me. And I'm so embarrassed. I feel awkward. And so I sheepishly interrupt him and say, I don't understand Navajo. And everybody burst out laughing. And then he said, you sure talked up a storm last night.
For somebody that doesn't understand it.
So people always ask, how do you explain it? I just want to be honest. I don't know, but I experienced it and they witnessed it. And then often people give their own explanation. They say all the information, past, present, and future, is out there in the ethers, and when you're on, you can have access to some of those things. Why? Because the structures of what your the common narrative that things are a certain way, you drop that when you're on the plant medicine, and you're opened to everything. And I thought, well, that's the best explanation I think I can come up with. What do you think, Alan?
Well, while you were saying it, my investigative mind was going to that while these things were being passed around, that other people were either saying things or chanting things or whatever, and that you were absorbing it so that once it came to you, it just came out of you. But I wasn't there, so I don't know. So that's more of a question for you of, you know, was other people chanting similar things that you may have absorbed?
if I absorbed it, I wasn't aware of it because I was more looking at the baby. I was very curious to see what was going on with the baby. And I was noticing the improvement throughout. That's another miracle. Improvement mm-hmm. throughout the whole ceremony until he looked absolutely normal and gurgling and looking at the mom and stuff like that. So that's what had my attention, frankly.
All right. We're talking with Erica Elliott. Her book is Medicine and Miracles in the High Desert, My Life Among the Navajo People. And maybe it should have been called My Love Amongst the Navajo People.
I like that.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about those miracles, and we're going to answer some of your questions that you've sent in. So stay with us. We'll be back. You're listening to...
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. We are talking with Dr. Erica Elliott, and we are talking about her time with the Navajo people, but we're also talking about a lot more. We're talking about love. We're talking about gratitude. We're talking about diversity, and we have some questions that have come in, and I want to thank those of you that take the time. I really appreciate it. And I know that there are many people that send in questions. They say, you know, hey, I'm a teacher. I'm in class in the middle of the day. You know, could you please ask this question? And I'll listen later on to get the answer. So, Erica, here is one of them. And this one reads, I grew up a few miles from a location taught in the elementary school there. It took a while to gain their acceptance, but then I, too, was welcomed into the inner circles and attended many ceremonies and events that changed my life. I believe their deep spirituality and connection with nature is far ahead of what we can even imagine in our Western culture. I'm very much looking forward to reading about your experiences and listening to this later on. It's from Beverly in Newport Beach.
That brings tears to my eyes because I'm imagining what she experienced. I was feeling for her the profoundness of her experience.
And another one that has come in, this one says, I studied herbology for 20 years with many indigenous healers. It pains me how the masses turn this up this knowledge, believing that our pill-laden pharmaceutical system has the only valid treatments for their medical needs. Can you share your perspective on this topic? And this is from Brandy in Colorado.
Yeah, I'm on board all the way. I mean, my experience with the Navajo people was life-changing, learning how they healed themselves because I was there 50 years ago. There is still full of very, very traditional Navajo people, especially the families that did not live in towns and lived in remote areas, like the parents of the boarding school kids, and then herding sheep and stuff. So I've been on board most of my life with, Beverly, what you're talking about. And herbs are a very important part of my practice. My practice is very eclectic, and I individualize my treatment. One size fits all, customized to each person. And so, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Well, one of the other things I really appreciated in the book is when you then talk about returning years later. So share with the audience when you returned later to treat the Navajo people, but you were now returning as a medical doctor. What did you witness, and how did they, how did they take you in?
Well, it was a very different experience because in Cuba, New Mexico, the town itself was all Hispanic ranchers, and there were no Navajos living there. The Navajo people would travel for miles and miles and miles way out just beyond the reservation and come in just to be seen. And so I didn't live with them this time, but I got very close to some of my patients, and I could see how some of them had adopted a Western diet and had suffering the consequences of all the processed food. And another thing that I noticed is that the white doctors there weren't very many. I was often all by myself for this huge clinic and little ER and little hospital. But when other doctors would come through, the patients would barely talk to them. And when I started talking to them in Navajo, like I remember my first grandmother who I said in Navajo, I said, come on in and sit down. And she was so speechless. She said in Navajo, she said, are you Navajo? She was kind of confused. And I just, no, I said, I was used to live on the reservation. And so when I talked Navajo, then they really opened up. And so white people often judge them for, you know, not talking and not giving a history and stuff. And that's because they were so shy and some of them didn't speak English. And so I saw a different side of these people. And then something else that happened is they were very forgiving with me. I was straight out of my training, dropped into the deep end, doing stuff that I wasn't trained to do, that was way over my head, you know, delivering breech babies, setting compound fractures. These are all things that go to specialists. Mm-hmm. And I was trained in family practice, like, you know, sore throats and delivering normal with normal deliveries and so forth. I was not trained as an ER doctor or a hospitalist. So it was so intense for me and flying by the seat of my pants, being by myself. And one of the doctors said, you know, they're so forgiving of you when you don't know something. I think they know that you really care about them because with us, they get really angry with us when we can't solve their problem or we don't set their fracture properly or something. They get furious and they never get mad at you. In fact, they bring you presents. They make you gifts, little weavings and stuff like that. So it's amazing when there's love and an attempt to bridge the cultural divide, how magical it is.
And, you know, there's a lesson there that I want to share with everybody. The concept of attempting to speak someone's language when you're in their land, it's huge. And it's something that I've done all of my career in working cases in other countries. And there are places, I'm sure there still is, to where they would refer to the ugly American. And what they meant was that the ugly American that would come over and speak to them in English, and when they didn't respond in English, the ugly American would get upset. You know, it's like, well, why don't you just speak English? You know, and I looked at it as in every country that I went, I tried to learn a little bit of their language. And as you said, even if you do a terrible job, you've shown them the respect. You know, there's a respect that they feel like, look, this person is respecting our culture. Now, you know, they're killing our language, but they're respecting our culture enough to try to do this. And I think that allows a closeness much faster than unfortunately what I was running into. And it sounds like you may have run into with with them dealing with some of the American or white doctors or teachers that was expecting them to instantly adapt to whatever we were saying, which we're guests there. So I think if everybody, I wanted to touch on that because there was so many great things you were talking about. I didn't want some of our viewers or listeners to miss that there's a huge lesson there for dealing with most any other culture.
That's right. They're so moved that you even try. Like you say, even if you bungle it, just the fact that you try shows respect.
Mm-hmm. Another question that has come in. This one reads, I have worked in multiple residential treatment centers where American Indian culture is taught to at-risk youth. It gives them a structure and grounding that many are missing in their lives. I would like to see this taught in all schools. What is your thought on that? And if you agree, how could we get these teachings into our public school system? And this is from Michael in St. George, Utah.
Of course, I agree. I mean, can you imagine if we lost our culture and we were dropped into some foreign culture? We would be so disoriented, and some people would not make it. They'd end up using drugs or alcohol or suicide. I think it's awful to be without your roots. It's terrible. And some Native people have been so assimilated that they know how to bridge those worlds, but many have not, and they suffer terribly. It's really horrible. And what could be done about it? It might have to be done regionally as opposed to nationally. I think things could happen more quickly regionally, but
yeah, I was going to say, I think that's a good point is that, you know, if you start in some areas, and we know that, you know, our education system, they want an example of it succeeding before they'll go further. And so I think, as you say, if we did it regionally or we did it in a particular school district and then showed the value. But I think what Michael is talking about isn't as much making sure that the indigenous people get education into their own culture, but that those of us that come from a more European background or whatever.
See, that's what he meant. Yes. I think that's important because then you can really reach these students in a meaningful way. Otherwise, it's just like the white teachers at my boarding school 50 years ago, they were just wasting their time and the students' time. No education was happening.
Yeah. And, you know, when you mentioned about some of the patients, when you were now operating as a doctor and how the other doctors, the white doctors, are saying, wow, they're relating to you so much better. Maybe one of the things is that they weren't buying into the fact when you just say, here, take this pill and come back next week. They're not seeing that as someone who is really interested in them as much as just, let me get you out of here and get to the next person.
Absolutely, Alan. I want to tell you something funny, and the listeners, sure. It's not funny, it's sad, but it's funny too. I heard them talking about doctors in Navajo among themselves, mm-hmm. And I realized the word they were using for white doctors was azethini, which means he who gives out pills.
There you go.
There you go.
Yeah. And they wonder why they couldn't get close to them.
Okay. Right.
we've got about 3 minutes. I'm so glad not only to have you on here, but I do want to have you back. I think there's so much more that we could talk about, and that there's so much more that everybody could gain from your experiences. And again, if you want to get the book, you know, I would imagine it can be gotten most anywhere. Is there anywhere special they can get the book, or is it Barnes & Noble and Amazon and everywhere else?
Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or through Inner Traditions, the publisher.
Okay. So that's Inner Traditions. Is that innertraditions.com?
Inner Traditions. I actually am sorry. I didn't come prepared with the website. I don't know. But if you Google Inner Traditions Publishing Company, the website will come up. But Amazon, I don't know if you are into supporting them, but that's really an easy way to get it.
Yeah. Yeah. I like adding in the publishing company and things because I also think that we should do everything we can to support small business and local business.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
So anyway, and again, so again, we just have a couple of minutes. What is a message in closing that you would like everybody to have a takeaway with this?
If you meet somebody who's different from you, either in their way of thinking or their color or their culture or their language, if you try to step in their shoes and see the way they see the world, it can make a profound difference. And if you care about that person, it can make an even deeper difference in the world.
Absolutely. Erica, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for writing the book. Please know that I'm very grateful that you are one of the many people that are out there making a positive difference in the world.
And I feel the same way about you. I think you're doing something very important.
Well, thank you for that. And if you get out to Southern California, let's plan on getting together and compare notes and see how we can make an even bigger change.
That's great. And if you want me to come back, I'm happy to.
Would love it. Thank you.
Okay.
For everybody out there, please be sure to join us next week when our guest will be Florence Ann Romano. She is the author of Separation Anxiety and Back to School, Facilitating a Smooth Transition. And this is a subject that's been compounded by the way governments have treated children during this highly politicized pandemic. So for everybody, be with us then. And if you get the opportunity, please go to our archives of past interviews at answers.network and subscribe to our show through whatever platform you listen to us on. And for everybody, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
Hello, I'm Marty Cove. You might remember me from roles such as Sensei in the Karate Kid films. I've done over 100 films and countless stunts in my career, and I've always given 100%. With the damage done to my body over time, I needed to find relief from my chronic pain. My passion for health and fitness drove me to find a natural way to combat muscle pain. Teaming up with doctors, detectives, and a compounding pharmacist, we've created Marty's Cobra Cove Ultra Strength CBD Cream. It's the only thing that has been strong enough to knock out my pain, and fast. Honestly, you may have tried the rest, but it's time to try the best. It's legal, it's safe, and 100% effective. Show your pain no mercy. Go to www.martyscobracove.com.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Radio.